BTAC stores until Major 5, and then here in 1991-92, when Major 5 was beginning to be implemented, then you saw that personal income taxes then overtook property taxes as the largest single revenue source for the state. And again, the personal income tax is it deposited into our general fund, where property taxes is the local tax, and it is something that is retained locally, and we do not have any property taxes at the state level.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Elizabeth, can you predict what would have happened had Measure 5 not been implemented? In other words, can you predict the path of that red line from 89-90 forward?
Well, Senator Corcoran, really that's a great question, but it is something that Mazen will discuss. He has a great graph, and that'll be tomorrow.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
So property tax, you know, yes, we can show you the trends in real market value versus assessed value how that would be affecting property taxes. But really, I just wanted to briefly, you know, talk about property taxes, but today...
I'm not going to ask any more questions.
Okay, please,
I'm
not property taxes.
Tax,
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hannon.
At what point in the personal income tax you have there on the graph between 2000-2001 when you saw the dramatic drop in the income tax? At what point in 2000-2001 did that drop actually commence to drop?
Senator Hannon, well, I don't know if you remember, but the forecast, you know, really started to reflect a drop in revenue right after our May 2001 forecast. So, it, you know, we started seeing in our September 2001 forecast. So that's the first time. I mean, this is reflected. Remember, this is fiscal year. This is looking at 2000 tax year versus 2001. So we really saw the, you know, drop here between tax year 2000 and tax year 2001. But the exact month and things, you know, was starting to decline, and the state economists began to pick it up right after.
When we adopted the 2001-2003 budget in 2001, we adopted predicated on the fact that blue line on personal income tax was going up, not coming down. And at what point in that time frame, when we adopted the 2001-2003 budget, did it occur with that downturn start to occur? Because I recall in Ways and Means in 2001 we were predicated upon revenues at least either remaining constant or even possibly increasing.
Senator Hannon, that's correct, and that was the assumption that was made in the forecast. But I do have another slide later on where it is month by month withholdings, and at least I could show you with the withholdings portion and how it started to decline and when it started to decline.
Okay.
And
thank you.
That may be helpful in answering your question. Mm-hmm. So as you can see here, personal income tax, you know, dropped significantly. It dropped about $850 million there between 2001 and 2001-02. Went from 4.55 billion to 3.7 billion. But as you can see, the corporate income tax obviously had the same corresponding drop during that same period. But on a percentage basis, the corporate income tax really dropped a larger percentage than the personal income tax. This dropped almost 50% between 2001 and 2001-02 fiscal years. And I think the important thing to remember is just to look at these trends of the corporate income tax. And, you know, what really was during the 80s fairly constant. I mean, it bopped around a little bit, but you did not see the real gains until about 92 in the beginning of the 90s there when you started having some new high-tech investment in the state. And then you saw the real significant growth. So, you know, it's a question of what is the long-term trends then for the corporate income tax, and that's why you see now our forecasts have this corporate income tax you know, staying, not going back to these late 90s level anytime soon. And it's because of these long-term trends that you can see during the 80s that corporate income tax was not up at these high levels that we saw in the late 90s.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add on Senator Hannon's question on terms of the personal income tax. Remember, there were some external factors that caused those dollars to go down. One was, as soon as the biennium began, we sent out, Department of Revenue sent out the final phase of the refund on federal pension income, and that was about $110 million. So that was actually built in the forecast, but that caused a decrease, and then you also had a kicker refund of $250 million going out in the fall. So these numbers here are just raw collections. So part of it is, it doesn't explain why the forecast was off, but that does explain partially that drop.
Mr. Chairman? Then, Paul, can you indicate to us what portion of that blue line decline is attributable to the kicker versus how much is attributable to the other policy decisions that were made on expenditure reductions?
Senator Hann, I believe that that personal income dropped in the neighborhood of $700 million from the prior year, and that's that straight line drop there. It looks like about $700 million, and that's, the general fund was dropped by $910 million, as you recall from the chart we had yesterday. I think about $700 million of that was from the personal income. And of that $700 million, you had $250 million on the kicker and another $110 million on the refund on the federal pension income. So that was about $350 million, about half of that drop was really legislated. What the forecast assumed was that you would see some offsetting growth in the economy, and so that the raw collections would be about flat, but it would be there would be enough growth to offset those two big refunds, and that's what didn't happen.
The irony of the twist, Mr. Chairman, is the fact that what we gave back, we're now trying to collect as of next Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
The Lord, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away.
Mr. Chairman,
well, in that regard, when was the last kicker that kicked? Wasn't it in 98? And that certainly doesn't show in that.
Senator, you can see where see the little flat lines there, the little plateau. That's, you can see kind of a slowing of the slope there. So the kicker affects those the rate of growth. But you're right. What's happened is you had enough growth and the other factors to offset that and still push it up for the next year. So you'll just have a sharp increase because you come off an artificially low level.
Okay, and I guess the other correlation that we don't have on this graph is the spending. And it follows the blue curve precisely. We got it. We spent it. So when our good colleague from Ashland says that there is a giving and a taking away, I think that's multidimensional. We took it. We spent it.
Senator Corcoran, did you have any more property tax questions before we move on?
You know, do we have that age requirement for the Senate bill still kicking around?
It sounds like there's an echo going on in this room.
Please proceed, Mr. New Chair.
To go to the next slide and just to kind of elaborate on this discussion is just to look and compare the general fund revenues between the 99-01 biennium and the 2001-03. And the 99-01 biennium, you saw a total of $10.1 billion, where obviously the primary component of the general fund revenues is personal income tax at 87%. And it was $8.7 billion in the 99-01 biennium, where corporate income tax made 7% of the total at $755 million. Now, the other taxes are like cigarette tax and the wake mile tax. That was roughly 3%. And the other non-tax revenues are like liquor licenses fees and other fees that the state collects. So that was only 3% in the 99-01 biennium. But then in the 2001-03 biennium, the big change here is you did see a drop here in personal income tax over the biennium of $600 million. But on a percentage basis, personal income tax did not drop as fast as the other components, like the corporate income tax dropped the fastest, losing, going from a 7% of the total general fund biennium budget to 4%. So it dropped to $395 million. And then the other taxes grew slightly from 3% to 4% of the biennium's budget. And the other non-tax revenues, they grew from 3% to 5%. And that's due to one-time transfers that were made of other revenue sources into the general fund.
Mr. Chairman, where would capital gains be reflected in the personal income tax? How much of a reduction of the 8.7 to the 8.1 is attributable to capital gains?
Senator Hannon, I do have a graph coming up showing the fall, preliminary numbers anyway from the 2001, which shows capital gains, what percent it is of that fall.
Okay, thanks.
So now, with the personal income tax, I'm just going to kind of go through logically how you would fill out, you know, your tax return, and that in some ways helps you understand kind of the basis for our personal income tax. And income taxes are a tax that's applied to income earned by not only individuals but also businesses. You have the small businesses that pay the personal income tax. And to begin with, you start here in Oregon with the federally adjusted gross income. And since 1997, Oregon has been permanently tied to the federal definition of taxable income. So we are tied to any changes that are made at the federal level to this federally adjusted gross income. And please be aware that even though there's this word adjusted in there, that doesn't mean that's after all the subtractions and deductions and things. This is, the adjustments just refers to a few a small number of people each year take. There's IRA deductions, student loan interest deductions, moving expenses, and self-employment health insurance deductions. That's all that's included in that adjustment portion. So federally adjusted gross income is your total income. That's summing up all your wages and any interest income you may have, dividend income, stock income that you may have gotten from selling stocks. All that becomes part, then, of your federally adjusted gross income. And then there, you minus off the adjustments in order to get, then, this base. And so just recognize some people get confused, and I know I've gotten a lot of calls, even just dealing with Measure 28, because we have the federally adjusted gross income as part of our table on the ballot. And so people think this is, you know, taxable income. This is not taxable. This is not after all the deductions. This is just a few adjustments that are made at the federal level. Everyone can qualify for those. So then, once you have your federally adjusted gross income, then the next step is to add some Oregon additions. Now, this is income that the federal government does not tax, but Oregon does. So the ones that are in that category are interest on government bonds and non-Oregon bonds, interest and dividend income of minor children, gambling losses, which were claimed as itemized deductions. And then also, if you want to claim certain credits here in Oregon, like we have the long-term care credit, well, if you want to claim that, you're going to have to first add in the federal long-term care insurance premiums that were removed from that base, and also any differences in depreciation. So that's the first step, is add in the additions, and then you have subtractions. Now, these are just the opposite of addition. So subtraction is the income that the federal government does tax, but Oregon does not. So then what you have in that category, and the biggest one, is the federal income tax subtraction. And that's Measure 88 that Oregonians voted in 2000. And then we saw the phase in the third special session. So now in 2002 tax year, which is what we will be filing for in April 2003 now this year, the limit here is $3,250, and this is phased up just like to the level of Measure 88 of $5,000. It's actually a bit higher. It's $5,500 when it becomes indexed.
Elizabeth? Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Do you have the number for we moved from $3,000 in tax year 2001 to $3,250 in 2002. do you know what that number represents? I know that we had a dramatic fall off of income, so it would be less maybe than was anticipated, but what were those numbers for 2000 and 2001?
Senator Corcoran, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I can sure get to that. I mean, that would be the revenue impact, you know, because we looked at various options and stuff while we were discussing this, the third special session.
I guess I would like to see, Mr. Chair, the overall impact of ballot measure 88. Maybe just put it that way. The effect on revenue to the state.
Yeah, versus 3,000 though, or versus 5,000.
From the did it start at 3,000? I thought it started lower.
Well, remember we when it was approved by voters, it was set at 5,000 and then be indexed. Okay, but originally before Measure 88 was approved, it was 3,000.
Okay.
Indexed.
So then it would only be for those 2 years. I
okay, but you want it compared to 3,000 or 5,000?
I want compared to 5,000,
okay.
And I want to know the total foregone with Measure 88.
Okay.
Thanks.
Now, the next step then is to look at deductions. So you've taken out the subtractions. Now we need to, as a taxpayer, decide whether you're going to take a standard deduction or itemized deduction. And obviously the one that is going to produce you the lowest tax is the one that you're going to take, and the largest is the one that you would choose. And for a standard deduction, these are now, we have eliminated the marriage penalty, so the single is $1,640, and then twice that much is the joint at $3,280. And with standard deductions, there's also additional deductions if you or your spouse are over the age of 65 years old or blind. And then with itemized deductions, what you're doing is looking at your federal, again, this is another way in which we are connected with the federal tax system, not only through the federal adjusted gross income setting the base of what is in our income stream, but also these deductions. So you start from your federal itemized deductions, and then you're going to minus off just the state income tax and then any special medical deduction that you may qualify for. And then that becomes the amount of Oregon itemized deductions that you could choose. So once you've taken the additions, added those in, you've taken out the subtractions and taken out the deductions, then you're left with Oregon taxable income. And again, this is the thing that is applied to the tax rates. This is the thing that when you look at the tax tables in your when you're filling out your taxes, this is what you look at. The category of income is on those tax tables. It's not your federally adjusted gross income, it's your taxable income. And just one last point is you will be seeing throughout session, you know, various runs of the personal income tax calculator in which you'll see a distributional breakdown of the different impacts. Please be aware that, you know, even though the model is going to be calculating, you know, the taxable income for our sample of filers, you know, what we'll be printing out and giving to you is the total income groups. Okay, up here at the top, the federally adjusted gross income, the total income groups, so that it gives people much more of a sense of where they would fall in the different income groups. Most taxpayers don't know what their taxable income is until they pay taxes, and some of them don't even know from the standpoint they may have a CPA do their taxes. So when we give you distributional breakdown, again, this is going to be the total income you'll be looking at in the different categories. Yeah, to just kind of, I get a lot of questions about just what are the, you know, top five subtractions and deductions and things. So I just wanted to give you a snapshot of tax year 2000 and what were some of kind of the major components of each of these. So for the Oregon subtractions in tax year 2000, you had for full year returns, you had a total of $5.1 billion, where roughly $2.4 billion was the federal income tax subtraction. So people being able to subtract off, you know, their tax that they paid at the federal level is a very large subtraction. And on a percentage basis, it's like 47% of all subtractions were the federal income tax subtraction. And then also, Oregon does not tax Social Security. So $1.1 billion of the subtractions was for Social Security. That's about 22%. And then federal pension income is not taxed, and so that's $719 million in 2000, and that's roughly about 14%. And then the Oregon tax refunds, so any kicker checks and stuff, that is not taxed, and that was $345 million, and that was roughly 7%. And interest from U.S. bonds, that was not taxed also, and that's $306 million, and that's roughly 6% of the total.
Mr. Chair?
Sir, Corcoran.
So then, was that federal income tax number then the number that I'm looking for in terms of ballot measure 88?
No.
Senator Corcoran, that's all the federal income tax subtraction, right?
Okay.
That's a total amount.
Mm-hmm.
You're just going to be looking at that incremental difference.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Inga, just to go back one, is that the federal pension income, is that what that lawsuit was about? Yeah, okay.
Senator Ringo, that's correct.
And we, could you give me just a 10-second? We could not tax that because...
Well, Senator Ringo, I don't remember the details of exactly why we couldn't tax it.
Okay.
That was just the outcome.
Because
we didn't tax first.
There was a disparity between the two.
I see.
Public versus private.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
So now all of the state all retirement income except for the federal pension is included in the taxable base, but there is a retirement income credit. So if you are a low income or Oregon senior, you can get a credit for a portion of your federal. Or for your pension income. Okay, so that's kind of the change that transpired from we are no longer taxing federal pension income, but we are bringing in the pensions of other state and local governments, and this is then it becomes part of the tax base, but then we have a credit now. So I think that the mistreatment was on the subtraction component. So then to look a bit at just the top five federal itemized deductions, and again, these are the ones that you report on your federal return, and then they get transferred to the Oregon return. To begin with, the total amount was $9.1 billion in 2000, and the two largest are clearly for homeowners. And the number one here is home mortgage insurance at $3.9 billion. And that was roughly 42% of the total was the home mortgage interest. And again, there's not a limit on how much interest you can deduct here. And property taxes was the second highest at $1 billion, and that was roughly 12%. So these two added together, the home mortgage interest and property taxes, was roughly 54% of all of these deductions. Now, the other charitable deductions, just so you're clear, other charitable... Their charitable contributions are categorized into education and health and then other. Well, the other category is the bigger of the three, and it's charitable contributions to religious and other nonprofit organizations. So you've got a whole large number of organizations that are in this. So contributions that you've made throughout the year, then that's what gets deducted. And there's roughly $1 billion in this category. And then medical and dental expenses are also allowed to be deducted. If you have more than 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, then that excess above 7.5% of the adjusted gross income, that amount of the medical and dental expenses can be considered as a deduction.
Elizabeth, do you know other states that are income similar in their income tax structure as ours? Do they have a similar breakdown of their expenditures, home mortgage?
Well, Senator Deckard, again, these are at the federal level, right? So any state that's connected with the federal definition of income tax would be, definition of taxable income would be having these same deductions. Okay. And same thing with down here, charitable contributions of education is roughly $215 million. Which was only about 2%. So, as you can see, being a homeowner is one of the biggest, advantages here to being able to itemize your deduction. Now, as you can see, this kind of explains also why some trends that we've seen in the standardized versus itemized selection of returns here in Oregon throughout from 1990 to 2000. So you can see here that over the past 10 years, the number of itemized returns has really grown. It grew from 423,987 returns to 671,453 returns. And that's basically an increase from 36% of returns in 1990 to 47% of returns in 2000. Now, one of the reasons that would make people want to itemize over the standard deduction would be if they became homeowners. So there has been an increase in home ownership, and especially in the late 90s, just due to these lower interest rates that we've been seeing. And also, as we see a growth in our adjusted gross income in the state, then you'll be seeing more home ownership, more people be able to qualify for homes as incomes increase. Now, as I was saying, we start with that taxable income. That's after all the additions and subtractions and deductions, and then we take that taxable income and multiply it by our rates. And here in Oregon, we have three rates, 5, 7, and 9%, and it's a progressive rate. So each taxpayer that falls within each of the different income groups is going to have a portion of each tax applied to it. And then after you multiply the taxable income by the rates, then you get the tax before credits. And then the tax, then you need to consider what tax credits you may qualify for. Now, the largest credit that we have here that's used each year is the personal exemption credit. And this exemption amount is indexed to inflation. So right now in 2002, it's $145, and you multiply that $145 times the number of personal exemptions that you have in your family. Then after you consider all the different credits you may qualify for and you minus off your credits, then that equals your tax too. So here in 2002 are the personal income tax rates. And this just gives you a breakdown of single versus joint. And with single, you can see that if you have less than $2,500 in income, you would pay 5%. Okay. Now, make $15,000 and you're a single person, the first $22,500 of your taxable income is taxed at 5% rate. And with joint returns, it's the first $5,000 of your taxable income is taxed at the 5% rate. And then if you have more than $2,500, then the income, taxable income between $2,500 and $6,250 is taxed at 7% rate. And for joint, the income between $5,000 and $12,500 is taxed at 7% rate. And then the income above $6,250 for single and $12,500 is taxed at the 9% rate.
How long have we had that structure? Do you know?
Senator Ringo, that has been in place since 1987.
For other states, is it similar so that you get to the top rate so quickly?
Senator Ringo, this is a fairly flat structure.
Right.
You know, I mean, we get to 9% quite quickly, and we don't have any higher rates. Now, like if you compare the federal tax rate structure, that's got six different income brackets. It goes from like 10% to 38.6% as far as tax rates. Now, with Measure 28, we were just changing this rate right here. Just changing the 9% to 9.5%. That's all we're doing. And so that's why you've been hearing that, you know, there's over 300,000 people that are not affected by Measure 28. That's because they're in the 5% or 7% bracket. Now, again, to just kind of give you a few of the top five Oregon credits for tax year 2000, you can see that the total amount was $423 million, of which $361 million was a personal exemption credit. And that's roughly 85% of the total. And then taxes paid to other states, and this has to be tax that was paid to other states on the same income that Oregon also taxed. Then that was $17 million. Now, the earned income credit and the working family credit and the child care credit, those are all credit designed for lower income Oregonians. And so if you have dependents and you're working, then this is something that you can claim different credits. The earned income is a function of the federal earned income credit, where you get 5% of the federal earned income credit. And with the working family credit, this is a percent of the qualified child care expenses that you incurred, where the highest rate is 40% of the child care expenses if you have income below 150% of the federal poverty guideline. And then finally, the child care credit is also for low-income Oregonians who have child care expenses. And if they can have 30% of those expenses claimed as a credit if you have less than $5,000 in income. But it phases down to 0% if you have income above $45,000. Now, here's a few more credits. And just to be clear, you know, if you want a good overview of all the different credits, you know, there's the tax expenditure report that's really is your best source for giving you a good snapshot of the different credits and subtractions and additions and things, too. But just so you know that this is kind of just a small portion, but these are the bigger credits that are available. There's, again, $423 million total, where personal was 85%, and this tax paid to other states is roughly coming in second at 4%. And these other, like working family credit and the earned income credit and the dependent care, those were all around 2%. Other credits is some business credits, like the pollution control credit, the renewable energy credit, and the retirement income credit is roughly about 1%. And political contributions are roughly about 1%.
This is, Mr. Chair? I mean, the pollution control tax credit is...
This considered is, in others.
But aren't these personal tax credits?
That's right. But small businesses can claim it.
As a sole proprietorship?
Yeah, sole proprietor. There's also S corporations that are in this data.
Thank you.
So that whole group equals 3%.
Correct. Huh?
Pollution.
Yeah, there's like alternative energy
R&D,
devices.
All that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, the bigger, we'll talk in more detail about the larger corporate credits, too, when we start talking about the corporate business side. But just so you're clear with this 3% here, that's just, you know, a variety of other credits, but it's including a lot of these businesses.
So we spend a decent portion of our time debating that 3%.
Well, Senator Deckard, I think you're also thinking, too, of some of the bigger corporate credits. Now, those are, you know, have a bigger impact.
Uh-huh.
But we're just talking about the small businesses here and the personal income tax
system.
Now, this graph is really supplements what Paul showed you yesterday. Remember when he showed you the J-shaped graph? Well, this is really one segment of that J-shaped graph. It's just taking out and looking at the income tax component and how that affects different income groups and what percent of the individual's income is paying for personal income tax. And so this is really like effective tax rate, and this is the rate after credits. So this is like a tax amount that would be due. So as you can see, the lowest income group between $0 and $10,000, they pay just roughly 2% of their income in tax, in personal income tax. But you can see here their credit, which is this red section here, the credit is about 1.5% of their income. So as we were talking about with these credits, you know, the working family credit and the earned income credit and the child care and dependent care, they're all geared towards low-income Oregonians. And that this is where it shows up then, because they begin to phase out once the income grows for Oregonians. So this credit amount is pretty stable here between, you know, 1.5%, maybe 1.6% until you know, income of 10,000 to 20,000, and then it starts to drop off. And that's the phasing out of these various credits. And then as you can see, as income gets quite large up here, it's the 500,000 income group, they only have a credit of probably 0.1%. So they're, and the reason why is because a lot of these credits too are they're fixed amounts. Say like the personal exemption credit's just $145, no matter what your income is. And so there's not a whole lot of credits that they can take either, and they're limited. and they may be at that limit. Then with, as you see income grow on your effective tax rate, it's growing up pretty significantly here at a steep and good pace until about $20,000 to $30,000, when basically these credits start really declining off. And then you see it, you know, it definitely has a progressive nature to it, and it's growing so that by the time you get to the $500,000 category, you're at an 8% effective tax rate. But if we looked at just the graph of just tax before credits, this would not be as steep as it is in the beginning. Okay, those credits are really creating this steep slope right here for those first lower income groups. Now to just kind of switch gears and kind of just help you understand a little bit of some of the changes over the last 10 years in terms of the distribution of tax returns. Now the gray bars here are 1990 returns versus 2000 returns in the green. And in 2000, there was a total of 1.6 million in tax returns versus 1990, which was 1.3 million. And you can see a drop here in the lowest income group between 1990 and 2000, a drop of almost 50,000 people in this group. And that's just showing the movement of filers into these higher income groups. And then between the $10,000 and $20,000 group, there wasn't much change at all. And the $20,000 to $30,000 group, this is where you're starting to see then, you know, a bit of an increase between 2000 and 1990, where 2000 is having more returns in these higher income groups versus 1990. And the largest single increase is between $60,000 and $100,000. You see an increase here of, you know, almost a 200,000. And then the highest income group, 100,000 or more, you're seeing triple what you saw in 1990. So there's three times as many people in this $100,000 category. Now to take a look then at these different components of adjusted gross income and how they have changed over the last 10 years. In 1990, we had $35 billion in adjusted gross income, of which 67% of that was wages. And the second largest component was interest and dividends, and that was at 9%. And their next largest there was other. And the other includes things like unemployment, farm wage, alimony, IRA distributions. And pension was roughly 6%, and capital gains here was only 3%. Okay. And business, which is the sole proprietors here, is 5%. But recognize that in this miscellaneous over here, this also has S corporations in there. It also has rent and royalty income and some other estate income. But these two together combined, we'd also give you a little better representation of the business, small business component of the adjusted gross income, which is roughly 8% there. Now to move to 2000. In 2000, there was $66 million in adjusted gross income. Now the wages here, the wages fell as a percent, meaning that the other components of adjusted gross income grew faster during the 1990s than wages did. Wages are now just 65% of the total. And one of the big changes, obviously, is capital gains. Capital gains went from in 1990 being only 3% to in 2000 being 9%. And that has really explained a lot of the volatility now that you've seen in the adjusted gross income, is this huge increase in capital gains. Pensions went up slightly. It went up from to 10%, but from what, 6% to 10%. And that's just showing the aging Oregon population. And really the business income, it was the sole proprietors were 5%, they're now 4%, but miscellaneous went up from 3% to 4%. So overall business didn't change a whole lot. It's just the S corporations grew a lot faster than the sole proprietors. And you'll see that next week when we talk some more about business income.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Hannah.
The capital gains that you show there in 2000 at 9%, Do you have an estimate what the capital gains will be now because of the substantial losses, both in business and the stock market?
Yeah, Senator Hannett, I have one graph that shows the difference between 2000 and 01. But okay. I can give you, too, if you want this actual pie graph with the preliminary 2001 data.
No, just an estimate. Is it going to be substantially down? And if it is substantially down, then how much does it substantially impact the personal income tax?
Yeah, Senator Hannon, we do have that in the preliminary 2001 numbers.
Okay.
And I can show you the graph coming up. And if that doesn't suffice, I can give you, you know, the raw numbers if you want the difference there.
Thank you.
Now, so with this, what obviously capital gains is a big change. The other one is the other category, just so you're clear what's in other. Again, it's unemployment, it's farm income. In 1990, we didn't see as many losses in farm income as we see now in 2000. So that's caused then this other category to go down. Also, unemployment was higher in 1990 versus 2000. Now, here is the change in the major components, Senator Hannon, between 2000 and 01. And again, this is preliminary data that we have from the Department of Revenue as of December 2002. Now, for the changes that we've seen in these components are wages from 2000 went up 1%. Well, that's not very much. That's not even keeping up with inflation. So what we probably have seen in this wage group is obviously some people getting unemployed, but maybe some people just having their hours reduced. Could also be the lack of bonuses that are given during this recession period. So wages normally would be growing at a little bit higher percentage than just 1%. Interest here fell 1%, and this could be due to some of the interest income that is not realized with the lower interest rates. Dividends fell by 22%. And that is corresponding with the capital gains also falling by 53%. So from our heights that we had in 2000 with capital gains, we're now seeing a drop of 53% of that. Now, the one that that you see that's obviously growing is when you have more unemployment, then the unemployment component has grown 62% from 2000. And the business and miscellaneous income, it fell at, you know, 2% for sole proprietors and 3% for S corporations. And IRA deductions fell roughly 4%, and alimony was up 3%. So, again, if you want the raw numbers, we can provide that, but this is just kind of a good snapshot at where the changes are. With another important point being, this is not a component of the adjusted gross income, but it gives you an indication of what happened here. And we had refunds that went up 51% between 2000 and 01. So that's a really big jump, and it also helps you understand that even our withholdings that we had were overestimating how much we were going to actually collect, because then we had some large refunds and much more substantial refunds to give out in 2001 versus 2000.
Mr. Sherman. Using that 53% capital gains loss, if we were to cut the capital gains loss, how does that translate into economic stimulus? Zero is still zero. And if you have a net loss of 53% and you cut it, how does that translate in economic stimulus?
Yeah, Senator Hannon, I have done some of those runs, and I can sure give you that. I don't remember off the top of my head what, you know, like going to 4% or 5% tax rate would be, but I can give you that.
Does it in fact show a stimulus?
Yeah, there are some feedback effects.
Are there? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
If I can add.
Yeah.
Senator Hannon, in response to your question, when we have a proposal before you, we really at pretty much at your discretion, but generally anything that has a large revenue impact, we'll run it through our tax incidence model that will give you some economic feedback effects. And, of course, the capital gains changes we have looked at over the years, but whatever the proposal is, we'll make a run on that and look at its impact, its stimulative impact, and make any adjustments necessary on the revenue impact to reflect that. So we'll do that full analysis on proposals, and we've already seen some in the hopper in that area.
Okay, thank you.
Now to just look at the distribution of adjusted gross income components. Now this is, again, 1990, where I think it's important just to, if nothing else, look at the shape of the curve. It's kind of a bell-shaped curve. It looks like a hill. This is important because in 2000, this really changed. And you can see here that you had roughly $2 billion here of the $35 billion, which is roughly 6%. Of the income being earned by those between $0 and $10,000. And most of that income there was wages, with a portion of dividends and interest, which could be some things in that category. There were some small businesses, a tiny little bit, and some pension income, and then other, which could include like farm income and also unemployment in that category. Now, the $10,000 to $20,000 category, you see here a slight increase, then that's roughly 12% of the total adjusted gross income. And there you're seeing a larger portion of the dividends and interest income, a larger portion of business, pensions, and other. And again, that's pretty constant percentages there all the way until $40,000 to $60,000 income group. And this is your largest income group as far as producing the largest amount of income for the state. And this produces roughly 23% of all the income. And the largest portion of that is clearly wages. Wages is almost producing $6 billion of the nearly $8 billion in income. And then the $60,000 to $100,000 category, you can see it's kind of evenly proportioned there with dividends and interest, business, capital gains are showing up there, pension, miscellaneous, which again is the S corporations, and the other, meaning unemployment and farm income. And the 100,000 plus income group is the smallest amount of wage as a percent of the total. So wages are only like 2.5 billion of the, you know, 5.3 billion. And all these others are making up a large portion of it. Dividends and interest, our large portion business income, and then capital gains is the largest of any other income group is in this 100,000 category. And miscellaneous, the S corporations, are largest in this income group. So now 1990, the shape has changed radically. Okay, it's an exponential curve. And what we're seeing is the 100,000 plus income group, they're paying 37% of the total income in the state in just this one income group. And the largest portion of the capital gains is almost entirely in this income group. And the pension income is a large portion there. And the miscellaneous doesn't hardly even exist in the other income groups, but in this 100,000 plus category. And the other is real small there. And the sole proprietors make up their largest portion also are in the 100,000 plus category. And then these income groups, you know, they're contributing more of the total. Like this is 24% of the total income is in the $60,000 to $100,000 category. But the $40,000 to $60,000 group, which before was the largest income group, is now producing only like 17% of the total income for the state. And then these other income groups have not changed very much. This is just a smaller portion. This is only 3% of all the income is in the 0 to 10,000 income group, where 10 to 20,000, they're each about 6%, 8%, 9%. Now, when we look at our average adjusted gross income between 2000 and 1990, what we see is in 1990, the average adjusted gross income was $26,610 versus 2000, where statewide it was $43,615. So this is quite a jump here statewide in just 10 years. And this jump in the average is really, I mean, as you can see from the graph, between zero and, you know, 100,000, these averages really didn't change that much. That means that the number of returns in these various income groups was growing at the same rate that the income was growing at. So then that really is this highest income group that is explaining the increase in this average adjusted gross income. And this increase is quite large. In 2000, you can see it went from roughly 200,000 on average to 230,000 on average. So this is what's pulling up the overall average, is this 100,000 income group. Now to kind of look at this and think of this geographically throughout the state, it's just kind of interesting to note now the differences in the range in the average adjusted gross income by county. Now, in the white here, those are the counties that have between 0 and 30,000 in adjusted gross income, and there's only four counties in that area, in that income group. And then the yellow here is between 30,000 and 40,000 in income, and there's 23 counties in that. And so you see that some of the rural counties here are quite comparable as far as their average adjusted gross income. But then you see some of the higher growth areas in the state, with like Deschutes County and Benton County and even Marion, and then obviously parts of the Portland TriMet area, which have really kind of fed from the growth in Portland. You see the $40,000 to $50,000 in average adjusted gross income in those counties, and there's six of those counties. And then finally, you just see Washington County and Clackamas being above $50,000. So there is a real disparity now between Wheeler County, with an average adjusted gross income of $26,143, versus Washington County at $63,409. Now, that's a difference of $27,000 in adjusted gross income. Over just 10 years, you know, we see this change.
Elizabeth, do you know what's fueling the aberration in Deschutes? Which sectors are fueling the aberration in Deschutes County?
Well, Deschutes has had a lot of tourism and stuff being built up there. And I think you've seen new companies go in there, too. I mean, so I think Bend has just grown as just kind of a more of a business area for a lot of the rural counties in the neighboring area too. So the average tax then, to just kind of take it one step further, again, the only difference between the average adjusted gross income and tax, there haven't been any differences between tax rates or anything. That's been the same. So it's just the income differences between the different counties that are creating these differences in tax. And again, between the white counties are between 0 and 1,500 in an average tax, with Wheeler being the lowest. And then the yellow counties have a 1,500 to basically 2,000 in tax. And there's 20 counties in the yellow group. And then in the 2,000 to 2,500, there's eight counties that have that average tax, and then above 2,500, there are four counties where Benton has moved up into that area above 2,500. But again, the highest average tax is Washington County at 4,147, and this difference between 4,147 and the 1,348. Is, you know, quite a difference here of 2,800.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
You know, I realize with the rearrangement of these seats that the chair has created an urban-rural split in this committee.
Never mind.
Yeah. You hadn't figured that out?
I just figured it out.
This is not the chair's idea on this seat switch.
Who are you going to blame it on? Senator Hannon?
It's chair takes responsibility for the situation.
Typical Multnomah County. They don't take responsibility for anything. No.
Okay.
They don't make a culture of the guard sign and leave faster.
Okay, then to move, if you think this back, what do you think it looked like 10 years ago? What was the average tax by county? What do you think it looked like? I mean, was there any yellow? Was there any blue? There was really only four counties here that were above 1,500. All the other counties were between $0 and $1,499 as an average tax. So in 10 years, we have grown from having a difference there of $2,800 to only having a difference here. Here we see Wheeler County of $857 versus Washington of $1,870. So it's been, you know, roughly $1,000 here difference between the lowest and the highest versus $2,800 10 years later. Now to just kind of switch gears a bit.
Could you go back, Ms. Chairman, could you go back to that previous? Mm-hmm. Can you show a direct correlation between the downfall of the timber industry and a reduction in the statewide tax average? Have you ever done any comparison like that economically to say, like in Jackson County, there's a 1,200 there in 1990. Part of that was a downfall from in the 1980s proportionately because you had more income tax because more people were employed in higher paid jobs as an example.
Yeah, Senator Hannon, I haven't studied that, yeah. But I think you could do it. I mean, it seems like you could look at that farm component and see how much that had changed.
Well, the reason I ask is it looks like the rest of the state is economically depressed. And if you look at an accurate picture today, we're even further behind the curve economically. As you go back to these previous maps, Grant County, some of the rural counties are particularly low in the average tax by the year 2000. By 1990, they really haven't increased that much between 1990 and 2000.
Okay.
And so there must be a direct correlation between the drop-off in the economy, mm-hmm. the drop-off in the wood products industry, drop-off in jobs in those rural areas as well.
Senator Hannon, I think you're correct. Yeah, we haven't really seen any analysis really in that.
Okay, thank you.
Senator, I think you're exactly right. What you're seeing is increased disparity among the regions.
Yeah.
And that's what that's reflecting.
It's really becoming very evident here in this colored map.
It's going to be very closely tied to amount of income. So as income per capita, as that widens across the state, then you're going to have a stretching out of the tax per filer.
So you can see Mr. Chairman, if we could look at the previous map.
1990?
Yeah. If you look at Malheur County at $910 and Harney County at $1,020. At that point in time in the 1990s, Snow Mountain Pine and a couple of other wood products processors were located in Burns. And in relative terms, they had a little bit better income than Malheur County. If you flip to the next map, by the year 2000, the wood processing facilities in the community closed. And in comparison to Malheur County, they lagged behind. So, I mean, that certainly is one thing where Malheur and Harney are primarily agriculture and cattle with a timber component. You can really identify it in
yeah.
Harney County there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Somewhat the same with Lake County.
Tom Patowski, Senator Hannon, has that slide.
Does he?
It was really dramatic. We went through it this morning. The incomes, where you see the disparity today, they were almost equal. Pre-spotted hour,
$5,000.
Yeah,
statewide.
I mean, if you look at Washington, Clackamas, and then you look at other counties, it was really dramatic that how the 90s, and a little bit before the 90s, but the 90s really exacerbated the split. And I thought it was pretty telling this morning when we went through the slides just to see that dramatic separation that occurred.
It'd be interesting to see that, that dynamics of what occurred during that period of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chairman,
your intuition is correct, though.
There's a policy implication as well, and often the dot never gets connected to the policy. You know, we see these facts and we, you know, ain't it awful, look at the disparity. But we had a conscious disinvestment policy in forest products during the decade immediately passed, and a conscious investment policy in high technology in metro areas in that decade. And the result is really clear. When we have a public policy decision made to disinvest in rural communities and in ag commodities and forestry, you get a predictable result. Just as you get a predictable result when we make a conscious effort to invest in urban areas and high technology. You get return on investment where you make it. Where you don't make it, you get erosion of economics.
Mr. Chair, I respectfully disagree just a bit. I mean, the factors that affected, I certainly agree that there's policy factors that affected timber take, but I mean, when you look at everything from WTO to, you know, Canadian subsidies to all the other impacts on the timber market, you have to take those into account. But I do agree that the federal policies have a big effect on it. But, you know, the only place they're cutting, the only place they've been cutting for the last 10 years is on private land. Mm.
And I guess, Mr. Chairman, just to, you know, amplify and agree with my colleague, it wasn't just federal policy. We did a lot of this to ourselves at the state level as well.
Elizabeth, do you want to jump in on... go ahead.
Well, I think you guys are all, you know, right in different respects. I mean, I think all those...
Nice to us.
No, but I think all those policies have an effect on, you know, the rural areas, so, and the urban areas. So. Okay, if you don't mind, I'm going to go on. Now, this is trying to give you an understanding, too, of when you're paying the tax and when these receipts come in, because many times there's a misconception that you only pay your taxes on April 15th each year, and this is really an indication here of how much we do pay throughout the year. So in 2000, we saw that the total tax returns were $1.4 million, but there were $1.2 million basically that had withholding. So that means all throughout tax year 2000, people were having a portion of their tax withheld during the year from their wages. And then you can see people also made estimated payments. 168,988 returns had estimated payments, and that was 12%. So we went, the estimated holdings were 83% of the returns, and 12% of the returns had estimated payments throughout the year. So you had a total of 95% of all the tax returns paid something in 2000 before they ever then rectified their tax liability in April of 2001. And the other kind of misconception is that when you pay your taxes in April of 15, that you actually have to send in a check to Salem. Well, that's not true. You can see that for the majority of the taxpayers, they got refunds. 954,934 refunds were given in 2000 versus half that amount that was for the taxes, the returns that actually had to pay something, and that was 401,840. So there was roughly 67% of all of our taxpayers got a refund, versus 28% that actually had to pay something. So that's a real difference. A lot of people don't realize that when you're having your taxes withheld from your wages, many times that is a very good way in which to allocate then how much you're going to have to pay April 15th, and many times you will be getting a refund. And then when you look at tax withheld dollar amount versus the estimated payments and refunds, you can see that tax withholdings there were $3.16 billion versus the total tax due, which was $4.2 billion. And that was roughly, withholdings were 75% of all of the tax due was brought in 2000 through your wage withholdings. And then estimated payments were $872 million, which was roughly 21% of that total tax due. and refunds here, you can see we're still larger than the tax that was actually paid on April 15th. The tax refunds were $556 million versus taxes paid, which was $424 million. And this, what also shows, though, is that the tax refunds on average were much smaller than the tax that was on average that was actually paid with returns. Now to look just briefly at some data that the Department of Revenue Research has been collecting and compiling. And this is a database that takes all the different employers and categorizes them by different industry sectors. And then from there, they have created an index. And this index begins on September of 1998. And that becomes a starting point for the index. And the index is consisting of each one of these points here represents 12 months of withholding payments. So these are all the monthly withholdings that come into the Department of Revenue, and this is compiling that data. So for each point, like, say, October of 1998, that's all the withholdings beginning October of 97 for 12 months ending October of 98. So then the index is basically the withholdings for the past 12 months from, like, October of 98 to October of 97 to October of 98 divided by your base time period, which in this case is September of 98. So that's what creates this index. So when you see these index, you can see most all these sectors, the black line here is all the sectors combined together. And the pink line here, the light pink here, is finance and insurance. The red line there is the manufacturing sector. And the blue line here is education. The green line here, dark green, is wholesale trade. And the mustard yellow line there is healthcare. And the light blue is retail trade. And then the kind of bright pink there is public administration. Now, what this index is telling you is, say, like with the black line here, this was increasing from September, this index was increasing from September of 1998 to, say, like January of 2001, when it kind of hit a plateau there. Okay, and then in January 2001, we see that it was roughly 1.2. Well, that what that means is that all these different sectors withholding payments had grown 20% from July of 1998. So that's what the index is telling you, is what percent these different sectors have grown from your starting point of July of 98. So it is just kind of interesting when you're asking kind of about the timing and when different sectors kind of started to see a fall off in their, you know, estimated payments. Like, say, the manufacturing sector, you know, the red line there, you can see from that January of 2001, you know, that was kind of their peak there. And then it started to fall from there, and it's been falling ever since. So this shows you how much it fell, though, on a percentage basis from your index of beginning of July of 98. And you see, like, right now the manufacturing sector, it's fallen below 1, which means it has fallen below the January of 1998 level that was withheld during that time period.
If I could add something here, Mr. Chair, Elizabeth, this is having this kind of breakdown, and also in terms of corporate payments coming in, Department of Revenue has been working on this, and we think it's something that's going to help forecasting accuracy by spotting turning points more quickly. And you can see the manufacturing, of course, is a leader into recession. You go to January of 01, that's right when the recession began. So it was the first indicator there, and we actually knew this at the time of the last session, but we weren't tracking the data to this detail as we are now. So we're hoping this is going to give us a better sense of when turning points occur and give you a better feel for what the revenue projections are going to be.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hanna.
Follow up on that, Paul. Where was the greatest loss in revenue out of those sectors?
In terms of which individual industries?
Was it manufacturing the greatest loss?
Oh, yes. Manufacturing is the red line, and you can see how it's pulling everything else down. It's led into the recession. It's been by far the deepest. And, you know, the indication of a recovery, which you don't see yet, see some flattening, but We're not going to have a recovery until that red line turns up.
Is that reflected in the corporate or the personal side?
It's reflected in both, but in a percentage basis, even more on the corporate payments.
Corporate,
we have corporate payments. But this is withholding that is sent in by the employers in those industries. So this is really reflecting their labor costs and how much withholding they're collecting from their employees.
I see. Okay.
So when will we have evidence of that red line turning back up? Now that we're January 03, or
3 months after it happens, Mr. Chairman.
Well, starting with our Democratic president.
You do. You have a Democratic president in the center. And it starts to
But he's Irish and he's inept. I'm talking about the big country.
Okay, so just to describe this graph a little bit more, some other sectors that you saw were falling off here. This blue here is retail trade, and wholesale trade has seen a large dip also. Now, the sectors, two major sectors that didn't see much of a drop off now since we've seen the recession is this mustard line, the healthcare industry, and the finance and insurance. Now, with finance and insurance, that could be due to refinancing, the lower interest rate spurs that industry. And then with the healthcare, you also are seeing in there growth in the demand for healthcare as well as our payments, you know, when as taxpayers and we have to pay into our own healthcare system, then that becomes like receipts then for the healthcare industry. And also you're seeing in this section or sector the home health, the assisted living. So all of that are been areas that have been growing in the state. Now I'm going to take this graph here and I'm going to, from July of 2001, I'm going to break it down a little bit further to the sectors that were just falling. So again, you get a little better sense of what has caused some of the recession and where it's been hit the most. So these are the industries with a little more detail in that have seen a decline in their withholdings between July of 2001 and November of 2002. So as you can see here, manufacturing is the largest. Okay, there's a decline of 800 and almost 90 million, and that was a decline of roughly 13%. And wholesale trade here declined 43 million during that time period, roughly 16%. Construction also declined 30 million, roughly 13%. And information, which is like media, both in print and television, that saw a decline also of like 24 million, or roughly 17%. Professional scientific and technical services also saw a drop of roughly 17 million or 8%. Retail trade was roughly 14 million or 5%. And arts, entertainment, and recreation is really the sector that fell the most on a percentage basis. It's not a real big sector, but it did fall 26%. And this is a sector that's very volatile depending on people's income. And utilities fell 6.8 million, or roughly 11%. Transportation and warehousing fell 5.6%, or roughly 4%. And mining was 388 million, or a drop of 11%. So from just these sectors alone here, you can see a drop of 238 million between this time period of July 2001 and November 2002. Now, we'll give you the same information when we talk about the corporate side, but recognize the withholdings here don't always reflect everything right away, and they may overestimate. And so what we saw, like we saw in that one graph, the refunds grew between 2000 and 01 over 50%. Okay, and that's what we will be seeing if you looked at the refund data here between July of 2001 and November 2002. It's grown over 50%. So withholdings are just one component. The other side is refunds. Now this, I just want to be clear and help everyone make sure we're all on the same page as far as, you know, who is paying Oregon's tax. And Oregon's tax is paid by not only full-year residents, but also part-year residents and non-resident taxpayers. And basically, the state has to have nexus to tax income that's earned by residents and the income that's coming from Oregon sources that are earned by non-residents. So to begin with, like part-year residents, you can think of somebody who lived in Oregon for a few months and then moved to California. Well, then they would just be paying Oregon taxes on that portion of income that they earned for those first 3 months if they were here for 3 months and then moved away. So that's all Oregon taxes is for that income that they earned here. Now, with non-residents, what you see is you could say you're a Vancouver, Washington, you live in Vancouver, Washington, were a Washington resident, and then you bought a house in Portland and you rented that house. Well, then that would be rental income that is, the source is Oregon. So then that would be such that you would be paying Oregon income taxes for that rental income that you earned here in Oregon. Now, the rest of the income that you earned in Washington State would not be taxed, but any absentee type of landlord would still be having to pay Oregon income tax for that part that they're earning here. And also the commuters that live in Vancouver and commute over to Portland each day. If the business is run out of Oregon, then it's Oregon income and they will be paying Oregon income tax. I just wanted to give you a quick example. This is not all that critical that, you know, you understand all the dimensions of the part year and non-resident taxpayers. But the important point is to recognize that for these different part year and non-resident taxpayers, you will be figuring out the portion of their federal income that is actually attributable to Oregon. So say this particular taxpayer had $20,000 in total income, and then they had various exempt income, and then they had additions, and they had subtractions, and so the total adjusted gross income at the federal level was $19,300. Well, if we see that Oregon's income, say like it was the absentee landlord and he just got $5,000 in rent throughout the year, then he would just be paying a fourth then of this, of Oregon's income. And what you do is figure out this percentage in the sense that the Oregon percentage becomes the total amount of adjusted gross income that was actually earned here in Oregon divided by your total federal adjusted gross income. And then that becomes the percentage that you use to multiply by the federal income. And this is used slightly differently with part-year residents. You're taking the tax rates and you're applying it to the federal income, and then you just take that resulting tax then and apply it times this percentage. And then your credits also get applied by this certain percentage. So you just get a percent of your credits, a percent of your tax, a percent of your deductions if you're a non-resident. And one last point with the personal income tax system is just the donations that you can choose to give each year on your tax return. And there are a total now of I think 17 different ones. There's only these seven that are actually on the tax form itself. But so then it becomes a question of, you know, whether you are on the top tier, which makes the tax form, versus the remaining 10 that are just in the booklet. So you can decide to choose other charitable organizations besides these that are listed, besides these seven, but these are the ones that get the most donations, and then you can choose one of the 10 others that is in the tax.
And does that list rotate, or does it...
Senator Deckert, no, I think it has to check. Is it rotating here?
It's supposed to rotate. I'm on the charitable tax write-off committee, and we review the applicants each year, and we're trying to set up a rotating basis for diabetes and other illnesses who have applied, but there's not adequate room on the tax form. Mm-hmm. For their application, so we're trying to modify the tax form to allow a list to be printed separately, and then you apply the check off.
Okay.
I don't see the Tony Corcoran donation category up there.
That's Stop Domestic
Violence.
I do suffer from Irish Alzheimer's, you know. I can get everything but the grudges.
Yeah, it was non-game wildlife.
I think the rule is you get like 10,000 signatures, and you can get on the list, so you could go out and solicit signatures.
I'm sure Senator Ferrioli would help me in Eastern Oregon if you hear those.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it would be my pleasure to get the good senator listed in Eastern Oregon.
Well, I think this is a source of controversy here, you know, with these checkoff donations and who gets to be on the top list. But anyway, the ones that have collected the most are a child abuse prevention at 27% of the total of 85,000. There was Alzheimer's research and the non-game wildlife at 19% each. And then it was the stop domestic violence at 16% and AIDS education at 12%. And then Habitat for Humanity is 4% and Head Start at 3%. Now, to just briefly round out this session is just to talk real briefly about the surplus kicker and then some changes from federal and state tax changes. So the 2% kicker, basically at the end of each biennium, these calculations are made where you're going to look at what is currently the corporate income tax revenues for the biennium and then whether or not they exceeded the close of service estimate by 2%. And if they exceeded the close of estimate by more than 2%, then the entire excess amount is credited to the corporate taxpayers, and it's paid back in proportion to how much tax that they paid. Now, there is another separate calculation, then, that is performed on all the other general fund revenues, less the corporate income tax, and looking at whether or not those collections now exceed the close of service estimate by 2% or more. And again, the close of service estimate is made on the May forecast at the beginning of the biennium. And again, if that close of service estimate, if the general fund revenues are more than 2% of the close of service estimate, then the entire excess is refunded to the personal income taxpayers. And again, this is done proportionally in everyone would get a fixed set amount as far as the percentage, but there would be larger checks then for those income taxpayers who paid more. Now, the history of the kicker. The kicker, you can see here we've had it for 12 different bienniums, and of the 12 bienniums, we've seen 7 different bienniums with a personal income tax kicker, and we've seen 5 bienniums with the corporate income tax kicker. And the largest personal income tax kicker was in the 95-97 biennium, where there was $432 million that was kicked back to taxpayers, and that was a 14% kicker. And we can see that our most recent kicker in 1999-01 biennium was $254 million. That's how much was kicked back. And then we see our largest corporate income tax kicker was in 1993-95 on a percentage basis. It was 50% of the liability at $167 million. And in 1995-97 biennium, it was $203 million, or 42%. Now, the kicker is now in the Constitution as of November of 2000, so that's one change to the kicker, and it's not as easy to make changes at all to the kicker. So basically, in the fall of each year, at the end of the biennium is when the kicker check goes out. So like in for the $254 million kicker in the 99-01 biennium, it went out in the fall of 2001. So to briefly go through Measure 28, just to make sure there's a few things that have been coming up that I just want to clarify and make sure everybody's clear on, is just as a summary, it was passed during the fifth special session in order to deal with the current budget shortfall in particular, and it's going to increase that top personal income tax rate to 9.5%, just that top rate. And then the corporate income tax rate goes from 6.6%, and it rises 5% to 6.93%. Now, those tax increases are just for 3 years, and it's beginning in tax year 2000. Now, this kind of adds to some of the confusion that we've been hearing about with looking at the fiscal numbers. People, when they get their voters' pamphlet, they see three different fiscal numbers, and the first one is raises $313 million in 2002-03 fiscal year, and then it goes down from there. Well, what people sometimes forget about is that this $313 million includes almost a year and a half of tax liability. That's, we're going to collect all of 2002 tax liability and the 2002-03 fiscal year, as well as a portion of the 2003 tax liability, because we're going to have withholding payments. The withholding tables will be changed, and we'll get withholdings for 2003 in the first 6 months of 2003, as well as we'll have estimated payments that will come in 2003. So that's why this estimate in 2002-03 fiscal year is higher than any other fiscal year. Then in 2003-04, I think it's like $242 million, and that's representing one full year of tax liability. And then in the third year, fiscal year, 2004-05, then that is only half a year of tax liability. So just help people understand that it's not like we're forecasting the, you know, Oregon economy to go down in the future. It's just that we are going to try to capture a large, almost half of this tax liability from this tax increase right now to deal with the current budget shortfall. And then in 2003-05 biennium, you see that if you look at that on a biennium basis, it's $414 million. Now, the average tax increase is $114, and in the voters' pamphlet, again, you can see a breakdown of by different industry groups, but again, it's an average for these different income groups. And the important thing to remember is if you have taxpayers that are greatly concerned about how much Measure 28 is going to cost them, the Department of Revenue now has two different tax tables. Now, in our 2002 tax return, so if they want to look on and get their tax forms and start and not, don't send them in before Measure 28, you know, January 28th, but if you just calculate, you know, how much, you know, your adjusted gross income is versus your taxable income, then you can look at the two, they've got two different tax tables, and taxpayers can find out right away what their Measure 28 impact will be. So that helps some people who are greatly interested in what exactly will be the impact. It's right there in the tax table. Now, with the Bush recovery plan, basically this is still in a very infant stage. According to the Joint Committee on Taxation, they haven't even seen any formal legal language yet. So we're just working from basically news reports and press releases on this. This is just kind of the backbone of it too, and I'm just going to talk real briefly, because this is something that we will begin to estimate if it does seem like this is going to be moving quickly, so we can get an understanding of how this will impact Oregon. Now, to begin with, the first one is eliminating double taxation on dividends. So this double taxation occurs when corporations are going to be taxed on their earnings and their profits, and then they go and they give dividends then also to their shareholders, but then those dividends are turned around and taxed then in the personal income tax system. So that's where you get this talk about double taxation, is when the corporate income entity is taxed in their earnings and their profits, and then they turn around and give dividends. So this is the biggest component of the Bush proposed economic recovery plan. And this will have a negative impact. And at this time, all we can kind of do simply is look at the kind of the high end of what impact this would have. And so this graph here just shows you the dividends, basically the income and then the number of returns. And as you can see, Oregon, we have quite a few returns, taxpayers who get dividends in the lower income categories. The majority of the returns between 0 and 80,000 are the ones who are getting some kind of dividends. But obviously, this pink line being the income amount, this is not where the majority of the dividend income is being, you know, received, is not at those lower income groups. And then you see that the majority of the dividend is in these between 100,000 and more in income. These are the taxpayers who are receiving the majority of the dividend income in Oregon.
That's true.
Senator Corcoran.
There's also been speculation that I don't consider it a double taxation, but the dividend taxation issue will change behavior of corporations in their releasing of dividends. That'll have an impact on
lack of capital for improvement and so forth. So that's, I imagine it's a hard one to predict. You can predict the actual dollars possibly based on the behavior in the past, but right. It's really hard to calculate future behavior, I would guess.
Senator Corcoran, that's right. I mean, some of those changes that will occur at the corporate level are just not going to be easily captured, and we'll probably just end up looking at our current data and information that we have on dividends and go from there. Our biggest thing, though, to begin with, is even just estimating the portion of the dividend income now that may not be double taxed. So that's one dimension that we'll have to begin to examine and look at some studies. But yes, there will be behavioral changes. You can already see it in some corporations wanting to now give dividends. It's going to make dividends more attractive. And it's not going to, you know, when you hold those earnings and profits more, and that increases your stock value. So, you know, then you could maybe not be seeing as many capital gains. So, you know, there's a trade-off there between dividends and capital gains. It's a matter of where you're realizing it.
Senator Corcoran, too, this is Elizabeth mentioned the Joint Committee on Taxation. That's where we get a lot of our input in terms of those kind of macro behavioral responses, and we have a good working relationship with them. And they'll try to think through some of those things and give national estimates, and then we can anticipate that on those kinds of decisions about what corporations do, Oregon is essentially going to follow the national trend.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Elizabeth,
could you go back just for a second to the Bush proposed economic recovery plan and tie into this dividend income and number of returns? If the Bush recovery plan were to be adopted, say, in its entirety, and the Oregon tax code is connected to the federal tax code, have you estimated what the potential loss is or what the economic swing is going to be income-wise to the state income tax and corporate side?
Yes, Senator Hannan. This at least gives you a high end here, because here the total dividend estimated tax could be as much as $100 million, basically $105 million. And okay. So that gives you the high end. But again, I was saying there's some of that dividend that may not be double taxed, so we're going to need to look
at that's what
make
I was trying
some adjustment.
To find is there a more definite scheme there of things that shows?
Yeah, we really haven't gone beyond this at this
okay.
point, but it is something I will be researching.
Okay, thank you.
One of my
we have some real issues, and Elizabeth's been working on this, how exactly that will be implemented. And there's a lot of issues involving how they're going to determine that, how they're actually going to deal with the double taxation and trace back the corporate return. So a lot of issues have been raised. I mean, it's like we've had a concept without seeing an actual bill. And that's, so we'll need to look at that to get a better sense. But also, those remember, keep in mind, some of those other components will actually increase our revenue. Anything that ends up reducing the federal tax rates, therefore, increases our revenue. So there is some offsetting factors there, too.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so this is our largest negative by far, will be this one right here, the double taxation on dividends. And this comes through in just the federally adjusted gross income, like we were saying. If you remove dividends at the federal level, then that's the loss in revenue we're seeing there. Now, the next component there is accelerating that 10% federal tax bracket. So you're going to be expanding then this 10% federal tax bracket. What that means then is you're going to have more people that'll get lower tax rates. Okay, so then that means when you have lower federal tax liability, when it feeds through with Measure 88 and our federal tax subtraction, then you're going to have less federal taxes to subtract from our Oregon income tax system. So that means Oregon's income goes up. Okay, so this is a positive here, accelerating. Any of these tax reductions, anything that's going to lower the federal tax liability is going to be a positive then for Oregon, because that's like a write-off. That's one of our subtractions from our base of income, of taxable income. And then again here, the accelerating the reduction in the income tax rates. So this is something also that will be a positive, because that means that Oregonians at the federal level would be paying less tax, so then when it comes to subtracting off their federal tax liability, it's going to be lower. And then this accelerating the reduction of the marriage penalty, basically they're going to be increasing the standard deduction for married individuals filing jointly, and so it'll be double the single. And this, again, is a way of reducing federal tax liability, which then gets transferred back into Oregon by a positive.
Do you have ballpark figures on what 2, 3, and 4?
Yeah, Senator Decker, no, I haven't done that yet. Yeah, I will, I promise. Now, the other component is to increase the federal child care credit by $400. So it's currently at $600. It was going to be phased in and by 2010 to be $1,000. They're just going to move this up right away to be $1,000. So it's increased $400. Again, this helps working families, and this is going to be a lowering, again, of your federal tax liability and increasing then our state tax. And then this increase in business expensing threshold. So now this is something that's going to be lowering businesses' net income. So this is something that will be brought through directly through the taxable income. So we will see a negative here. This is just like dividends, the double taxation on dividends. That's brought through directly from the federal income tax base. This is too, this increase in the business expensing threshold. So what happens is under current law, the business expensing threshold is $25,000. So the most you can deduct right away after you buy a new piece of property is $25,000. Well, this is increasing to $75,000. So this is such that, again, this would be a direct negative, and then it gets brought through then and less income to Oregon and less taxes to Oregon. And then finally, the final component is just providing similar tax relief to alternative minimum tax returns. And this is just increasing then the amount of the deduction for alternative minimum tax returns. So again, this is a reducing the federal tax liability, which will get fed back through and having more positive Oregon taxes. So the summary is you got two negatives, one and six here, and then you've got five different minuses. So that's what we need to do, is just then combine the revenue impact from all of these seven components. And that's basically it.
Thanks, Desmond.
But Mr. Chair, this does show why it's not only what the federal government changing its policy, but how it changes is so important to us. Because if they change credits or rates, it doesn't have a negative influence on us. If they change the base through exclusions or through increased deductions, then it does. So that's why we watch that so closely, because it has a very significant impact immediately on us.
And Senator Smith, I don't know where he is with his proposal, but it's proposed for, I believe, the 03, what would be our 03-05 biennium, providing relief to the states. So that being folded in would obviously have huge implications on our ways and means process. Thank you. We are adjourned.